The following program is being repeated because of widespread interest and public demand.
There is a capacity audience here at Carnegie Hall for this, the last concert by Arturo Toscanini and the NBC Symphony Orchestra in this winter series. Most of the members of the audience have risen. As I look over the orchestra floor, practically the entire floor is peopled with guests who are standing and applauding and signaling for or hoping that Maestro Toscanini will reappear again, so they can express their admiration and appreciation for the splendid series of concerts which he has conducted in this, his 17th year with the NBC Symphony. Continued applause from our audience here while the members of the NBC Symphony sit silently looking towards the stage entrance from which we expect the reappearance of Maestro Toscanini as his baton fell on the final accent of the Meistersinger Prelude. He walked slowly through the aisle between the first violins and portions of the second violins, his accustomed measured tread out the entrance here just below us at Carnegie Hall. Maestro Toscanini has not reappeared, and our audience, most of them standing in boxes and family circling on the orchestra floor, up to the very tip-top balcony of Carnegie Hall, where I see several rows of standees who have been silently attending throughout this entire concert, hoping for a reappearance of Maestro Toscanini so they can applaud him once again on this, his final appearance this season with the NBC Symphony.
The National Broadcasting Company presents The Man Behind the Legend, a tribute to Arturo Toscanini. This is Ben Grauer. For 14 years, I was privileged to be Arturo Toscanini's musical commentator on his broadcast concerts. The world knew Toscanini as a genius. We at NBC knew the genius, but we also knew the man. He was a member of our family. We knew the Toscanini who liked to play practical jokes on his friends, who loved to watch boxing on television, who sometimes went to parties and had a fine time, and at other times would sit in a corner and glower at everybody if he took any notice of the other guests at all. What kind of man was Toscanini, really? One of the people best able to answer that question is the musical director of NBC, Samuel Schatzenoff.
Arturo Toscanini was a two-sided man, in a way. When he was on the podium, he was one person. When he was off it, he was quite different. Very often you couldn't relate one to the other. I remember going to see him in Bayreuth, Germany. He was conducting at the Bayreuth Festival. And he asked me to come and see him during intermission of Tannhäuser. During the first intermission of Tannhäuser, I tried to get backstage. And I found a big line of people waiting to get in. And a man kept all of us in German what our names were. And he noted them down. And he said, "I will see whether the maestro will see you." He went away. And I looked up and down this line. In front of me, there was a middle-aged woman, a very charming woman, surrounded by a lot of other ladies. And I heard people around talking to her in German, in Italian, I mean. And I gathered that she was the daughter of the King of Italy. Either the daughter or the sister, I can't quite remember, but she was of the royal house. In back of me, there was an enormous man who attracted my attention because of his bulk. And I called over the man who was taking our names. I asked him who this extraordinary man was, and he said that was the King of Bulgaria, no less. And that both he and the princess would like to see Toscanini, visit Toscanini in his dressing room. We waited about 10 minutes, and then the man came out and said in a loud voice, "The maestro will see Mr. Schatzenhoff and Mr. Ugo," I think was the name, some such name which I didn't know. And I and a little Italian man left the line and walked, followed this man into the maestro's dressing room. I found the maestro sitting in a chair with a heating lamp on his shoulder. He was suffering from bursitis at that time, and he was really in great agony. Maestro greeted me warmly, although he was doubled up in pain. And then he greeted this little man as warmly as he did me and turned to me and introduced him. And he said, "You know, Ugo," or if that was his name, "he's such a dear. He's been my great friend for so many years. You know, he is the head waiter at the Milan Hotel where Verdi died. And he says, I see him very often. He's such a darling." Then he turned to him and he said, "Oh, you are so sweet for coming to see me." And then this man kissed his hand and the maestro withdrew it. It was all very touching. When it came to my turn, I said to him, "Maestro, perhaps they didn't tell you that there were some very important people who were waiting outside to see you." And he said, "Oh, what have I to do with important people?" I said, "Yes, but you don't know. There was the princess of the House of Savoy and the king of Bulgaria." And he said, "I don't want to see them. I have nothing to do with anybody of that nature." He said, "I am happy to see my friends only." I thought this cast an extraordinary light on this man who was the greatest in his field, and ordinarily you would think would like to hobnob with royalty and with the great ones of the world.
In 1936, Toscanini resigned his position with the New York Philharmonic and returned to Italy. His absence from American music was felt keenly, but Toscanini was not permanently lost to us. David Sarnoff, chairman of the board of the Radio Corporation of America, and Samuel Schatzenhoff persuaded Toscanini to return to the United States. Now, as director of the newly formed NBC Symphony Orchestra, which was organized especially for him. The first Toscanini concert with the NBC Symphony Orchestra took place on Christmas night, 1937. One of the members of the original NBC Symphony Orchestra is cellist and composer Alan Shulman. Alan, recall for us, what was it like working with the maestro?
My memories go back to some 19 years and 1 month ago, the first rehearsal that Maestro conducted with us prior to the debut of the orchestra on Christmas night of 1937. We had been primed for 3 months. We had been coached by Artur Rudzinski, and the orchestra had gone through the gamut of the orchestral repertoire from A to Z. And we were all on tenterhooks, and the place was as quiet as could be. There was no one around. I mean, everybody had made sure that Maestro would have perfect working conditions in Studio 8H, and that these few moments of silence before he came on, and then this little man came on in a work jacket, almost like a dentist jacket, you might say, except that it was in black, solid black with a high collar buttoned up, and he walked in, looked at the orchestra, said Brahms, and we went to work. And within 3 minutes, we were all so electrified, we were absolutely in a daze. At the intermission, and the entire orchestra was just beside itself. It was fabulous. This was an experience. Some of us in the orchestra had played with Maestro before. I was one of the youngest members of the orchestra, being 22 at the time. And it was a thrill for me that I shall never forget. There were many experiences over the years with Maestro, and the one thing that strikes me is his sincerity and his honesty and his devotion. This man gave his all to music. He gave his all in such a way, sometimes I think, that he prostrated himself at the pedestal, at the feet of the composer. Unfortunately, that is not the case with too many conductors. In other words, the music came first, and you did justice to the music. In fact, I remember him saying a few years ago, we were doing the Beethoven Eroica Symphony, and we'd finished the rehearsal of it, and he hesitated for a moment, and he said, "I've been conducting this music For 50 or more years, he says, and I have been wrong. He says, please, may we repeat it again, not for you, but for me. Now, that is self-evident as to the man's approach to music. There are many memories of being with Maestro, little things that he used to do, little gestures. He used to caress the orchestra. He used to browbeat them. And despite the fact that everybody referred to him as a tyrant, there was only one thing that the man was after, and that was to do justice to the music. I have seen him go into a rage and stalk off, rip his jacket, have the buttons go popping and crackle like a machine gun, and stalk off in a fury, and 10 minutes later, he'd be back on the podium and back to work again, because that was a marvelous release that he had. If he felt something, he got it off his chest and immediately was all right again, and then went back to work. There were some few instances where he didn't exactly come back and the rehearsal was called off, but the next day it was as if nothing had ever happened. Sort of an emotional purgative, I would call it. He used to ask us for many things. I said caress and browbeat us. He would sometimes ask for a delicate gesture. He would stroke his hand across his cheek and say, una carezza, a caress. He says, please, gentlemen. He says, no, it's not delicate. Sing, sing, sing. Canta, canta, canta. He was always asking for us to sing. In fact, he used to tell some interesting stories about himself as far as melody. This man worshipped melody. He said, when I was a cellist in the orchestra, back in Rio, he says, I was a bad boy. He says, because I never used to play the cello parts except when they carried melody. He says, when the cello parts were like the bass parts and had boom, 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 he says, I wasn't interested, and I used to cheat and play the violin part an octave lower. That was only one of the things about the man. I mean, just he worshipped. He had song. He had song in his heart. He would pull a silk handkerchief out of his lapel and just let it float to the floor, almost like a parachute, and say, gentlemen, gracefully, like that. Another time, the orchestra was playing much too loud, and he stopped. And he said, no, no, lontano, lontano, far away. He says, far away in Brooklyn.
On the podium, Toscanini was a dictator. He was so devoted to the music he was conducting that he would not tolerate a mistake and would work endlessly to see that the music was played as he heard it in his own mind. Driven by his love for the music, he could become savage and enraged. Perfection to the maestro meant more than the overall symphonic sweep of the orchestra. It meant the proper interpretation of every note the composer had written and for every instrument.
Remember tutti, every ball. Remember the small note. Remember the great note. Non posso mai, I cannot hear. Never, never, never. La 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 la.
Of the Toscanini temper, anecdotes were legion throughout the world of music. But always in his outbursts of anger, disgust, or resignation, there was a pleading tone that lured orchestras into an understanding of music as the maestro felt it. Listen to this example from a rehearsal.
Passione, dolore, sorrow, passion, enthusiasmo, but no sleep. When you play every note, put enthusiasm, like me. I am sorry, I don't enjoy. No, Tukundos, no. No, I hate Tukundos. I hate. Because I suffer too much. Stop. You look at me. Why, you are sorry? You believe that I am crazy? No. No. No, no. A sensitive, yes. Don't look at me in this way. Da capo.
What made Toscanini tower over all other conductors? Time magazine points out, at any given moment, the flute player or the violinist is concerned only with his own note, which the conductor must blend in time and volume with the playing of perhaps 100 others. And while concentrating on the notes being played at any given moment, the conductor must also have one part of his mind listening to the entire piece. He must be on guard not to exhaust prematurely in too early climax the excitement meant for a later one, to make each part shine for itself and fit in the whole. It is not a metronome that is required, but taste, talent, culture, and care, and some musical X besides. Toscanini had that X blazoned on his forehead. Thus, Time magazine. If dissatisfied with the performance, Toscanini was miserable. If the performance was superb, he said, not bad. This excerpt from La Traviata was not bad. Gillis was the radio producer and director of the NBC Symphony Orchestra concerts conducted by Arturo Toscanini. At the time of his association with the maestro, he was an aspiring young composer. One of his compositions, whimsically entitled Symphony 5½, was performed by the NBC Symphony.
I remember Maestro Toscanini backstage in Studio 8H and up in Carnegie Hall as producer of the NBC Symphony. It was part of my opportunity and job to call Maestro in his dressing room and tell him that we were almost ready to go on the air. There was almost a ritual every time I walked into the room and said, Maestro, we're almost ready to go. And he said, how many minutes? And I would say sometimes 3 minutes or 4 minutes. And if I said four, he would generally say that's too much time. 3 minutes, he would start at Carnegie Hall, walking down the stairs, immaculately dressed. As we entered the wings of the Carnegie Hall stage, I would put on the earphone so that I could hear Ben Grauer, who was in the control room above. And Maestro occasionally would point his baton at me and say, what is on the radio, as he called it. Sometimes he called me radio. Many times, or most of the time, he would say, Gili, do this, or Gili, what is this? As we would stand in the hall, I listening to the script as it was being read by Ben Grauer, I would then say, Maestro, 20 seconds, or Maestro, 40 seconds. All right, now it's time to go. And he would start off toward the stage. On one time, however, when I said to him, Maestro, 30 seconds, he started counting in Italian, uno, due, tre, quattro, much faster than 30 seconds, believe me, as he counted swiftly in Italian to 30 and marched out on the stage and gave a quick downbeat before Grauer had an opportunity really to announce the number. At Carnegie Hall, it was necessary for him to climb the steps into his dressing room. Maestro's knee sometimes bothered him, but this never seemed to make too much difference to him when he would leave the stage after the concert. He bounded up the steps much more agilely than a younger man. Most of us who were there at the wings when he came off stage to greet him were left behind as he went into the dressing room. And in the dressing room, of course, he sat in his chair while the hot, sweat-soaked clothes were removed from him and a towel Quick, brisk rub down, a little cologne for the hair, perhaps, and then into the famous dressing gown with the champ marked right across the front. And indeed, it was a garment well fitting to this champion of all champions.
Al Walker came to NBC in 1932. When Toscanini joined NBC, Al was assigned as Toscanini's personal assistant to see that things went smoothly for the maestro. Al, as he would be the first to point out, is not a musician.
My association with Maestro Toscanini is in a sort of a different vein of not knowing anything about music. I'll talk about him as a man. I have very fond memories of Maestro, and particularly his humane manner in which he approached everybody. For instance, when my late wife died, he was much affected by it, and he came over to see me in my home, and he really touched me. Another time, my dog was hurt, and for about 3 weeks, every day he'd ask me how my dog was. And things like that made him a real human being.
Al, did you ever witness any of the maestro's famous tantrums?
He had them in his off days with the orchestra, but to me, only once he called me stupid in 18 years. I never missed a rehearsal or a broadcast with him, and we finished the rehearsal, and he wasn't satisfied with his podium. So after he got dressed and on the way out of Carnegie Hall, he said, "We'll look over the podium." So, which we did, and we fixed it to his liking and went on home. In the meantime, one of the musicians had moved the podium, not knowing that we had fixed it to a certain spot. So I checked most everything before he went on the stage, and just that night I goofed. And I didn't look at the podium and didn't watch my chalk marks where I'd marked the ends of the podium where Maestro and I decide where it should be. So he played the first part of his concert, and he came back raving mad. I could see it in his eyes that he was really going to take me apart. And he called me stupido, stupido, and Maestro, what did I do? Stupid, you are stupid. So I let him go upstairs, and I stayed away from him. That was the first time I ever stayed away from him, the whole time I was with him. So I wasn't satisfied with his calling me stupid. I wanted to know why he called me stupid. So I went down, and sure enough, the podium was moved beyond the chalk mark, which put him into the orchestra that he had to turn around and direct either to the right or left. So I told all of that, his son, after the concert, because I was kind of burned up about it. And following Monday, after the preceding Saturday, which the concert was on, he came down, and with his head bowed low, he says, "Walker, you forgive me. It wasn't your fault." So I thought that was quite human of him to admit that he made a mistake.
In 1950, during the course of a six-week tour of 21 cities with the NBC Symphony Orchestra, America met Toscanini. Everybody had heard him on the radio, knew his records, and, of course, the fact that he was the great conductor. Now they were to meet him in person, and they fell in love with the peppery little man with the waving white hair. In Richmond, Virginia, one of the cities on the tour, he will never be forgotten. Jimmy Dolan, music librarian at NBC, was with Toscanini in Richmond.
On our tour in 1950 of the United States, when we arrived in Richmond, Maestro decided that he would like to play Dixie at the end of the performance. We had been playing Stars and Stripes, and he thought it would be nice to add Dixie along while we were in the South. So he had never conducted this and tried it over at a rehearsal, as we had some music along with us, but we weren't sure of the arrangement, how Maestro would like it. Anyway, I passed it out, and Maestro went through it. After the rehearsal, he called me and told me he wasn't too happy with the way that it went. Could I go over to William and Mary, which was the university there, and look up a first edition and maybe bring it back if I could, so that he could look at it and see the music in its original form before it had been arranged for orchestra. He went on then to visit Williamsburg, and after his visit came back by the hall. I had secured a copy of the song and had gone over it with a few people at the university as to the tempo and the way they do it there. And Meister was, of course, quite excited to get a look at the first copy and hear how it went. That night, after the performance, Maestro came back on the stage and mounted the podium to play an encore. The audience sat back, satisfied that they were going to hear some classical encore, but it wasn't until three or four bars passed they realized they were in Dixie. Everyone jumped to their feet, and there was a rousing ovation and demonstration after Maestro's program.
Listening to The Man Behind the Legend, a tribute to Arturo Toscanini. Part two will continue after a 10-second pause for station identification. The Man Behind the Legend, Part two.
When Toscanini was not on the podium, he could be gentle, kind, contrite, and solicitous. In 1940, at the request of the federal government, Toscanini took the NBC Symphony Orchestra on a 13,000-mile goodwill tour of South America. Samuel Schwarzenegger tells an especially illuminating anecdote that happened on this tour.
His kindness manifested itself one day to me and to Mr. John Royal, an executive of NBC, in a memorable July 4th in Montevideo. July 4th happened to be my birthday and Mr. Royal's. We got to Montevideo for a concert on July 4th in the evening. In the morning, the maestro called a rehearsal. We were all astonished that he would call a rehearsal of the same day at the concert, especially since they had played the program the night before in another city, and it had gone very well. And we couldn't imagine why he should call a 10 o'clock rehearsal. But anyway, everybody went. Maestro appeared, and he said to the men, "Gentlemen, I must apologize for dragging you out so early, but this is July 4th, your national holiday. I think we ought to play the Star-Spangled Banner." So the whole orchestra rose, and the maestro conducted one of the most stirring renditions of the national anthem I ever heard. Then when he finished that, he said, "And now let us play Happy Birthday to Mr. Royal and Mr. Schwarzenegger." And this great symphony orchestra burst out full-throated, giving us Happy Birthday in far Montevideo.
A particularly pleasant event for Maestro occurred when Local 802 of the American Federation of Musicians made him an honorary member. He liked to feel close to his men, and they loved him as well because they had learned to take his tantrums as he meant them, impersonally. The maestro was particularly fond of young composers. He would read their manuscripts. If he found merit, would offer advice and encouragement. Don Gillis recalls,
"I think perhaps the greatest inspiration to me in my long association with Toscanini as a man came the day when, after he had played Symphony 5½, he called me to his dressing room, and he spoke to me of having heard the recording of the Symphony No. 5, which Frank Black had done the year previously. And then he said, one day, I thought to be a composer too. But I decided not to. And he went to a nearby cabinet and brought to the piano some music, which across the front was written by Arturo Toscanini. And he played it for me. And he shrugged his shoulders and smiled sort of ruefully. And he said, I studied composition with Busoni. And although Busoni was just a few years older than I, one day when he said to me, Toscanini, the old harmonies are no good. We have to throw them away. He said that all of the old masters used up all of the ideas. And I said to him, Maestro Busoni, you're wrong. That isn't true. I said to him, Mozart used Do Maggiore, C-E-G, C major. And when he used it, it became Mozart. And Beethoven used C-E-G. And when Beethoven used it, it wasn't a C-E-G, it was Beethoven. And Wagner, C-E-G. And maybe Wagner added another note to make it just a little different. But even then, it C-E-G became Wagner. And each composer who has become a composer who wanted to speak to the people used the simple C-E-G, but first he made it his to make it sound like him. And then he said, in this moment of, I shall never forget, for as a composer it will serve always as a guide and inspiration to me, he said, I've heard your symphonies and played your symphony, and you have your own C-E-G, Do Maggiore, right and right and right.
Composer-cellist Alan Shulman recalls a visit with Maestro.
I remember going to visit him once at Riverdale with one of my colleagues. This was during a time that he was not conducting the orchestra, and he had been sitting all afternoon listening to test pressings of a recording that he made of the Beethoven Septet, and listened to this and listened to that, and then suddenly he said to us, did you hear the broadcast of so-and-so with such-and-such an orchestra last week? And we said, no, Maestro, we had not been able to hear it. He says, well, he says, I heard it. And he says, I got so angry that I sat down and wrote a letter. He says, I didn't mail it, of course. He says, but I had to write that letter. And he read us one sentence out of that letter, and that sentence will remain with me for the rest of my years. And that was, blessed are the arts that can survive without the aid of interpreters.
All his life, Toscanini was a passionately patriotic Italian. He was once asked why he had never become an American citizen. He replied, I was born an Italian, I will die an Italian, but my children will be Americans. He hated Mussolini almost fanatically. During the time of Il Duce's rise to power, Samuel Schwarzenegger visited Toscanini in Milan. Mr. Schwarzenegger recalls an incident from this visit.
One day, the maestro and his wife took me to dinner in a very popular restaurant in the Galleria in Milan. It happened to be the day when Mussolini was in town, and Ciano and all the fascists, and there was big celebrations in the streets and marching troops and so on. We sat down at a table, and the maestro questioned me about my trip, and I told him that my boat first stopped at Naples, and then unwittingly I said, well, if Mussolini hasn't done anything, he certainly cleaned up that town. When I said the word Mussolini, maestro grew white in the face and screamed at the top of his voice, don't speak about that assassin. I wish I could kill him. The place was crowded with diners, and I looked around me. I was terrified at what might happen. I looked around me. There were about 500 people in this vast dining room. Nobody was looking up. Everybody was carefully intent on their knives and forks. And I could see that they were all heart and soul with Toscanini, and they were pretending that they hadn't heard him.
Another sidelight on the maestro's love of his native Italy comes to us from NBC announcer Jack Costello.
It was my privilege and pleasure to act as narrator on several of the NBC symphony concerts conducted by Maestro Toscanini. One in particular stays in my mind, will stay in my mind forever.
During the war, three programs were set up. As I remember it, they were titled Victory, Act 1, 2, and 3, depicting the downfalls of three of the dictators of World War II. The first one depicted the downfall of Mussolini. It was beautifully rehearsed with the NBC Symphony Orchestra, the maestro to conduct. In the program, he was to conduct a chorus of the Garibaldi hymn. As he raised his baton to swing into the chorus, we were all watching this fragile little man standing at the podium, his hair sticking out wildly. The orchestra began to play the Garibaldi hymn, and the maestro wept like a child, shouting joyously over the freedom of his beloved Italy. And this emotion extended itself to the orchestra and to myself, and we all stood there weeping with the maestro without shame, sharing his joy over the freedom of Italy. The maestro was so overcome that he didn't play just one chorus. He played several choruses, with the result that the timing of the program was completely gone, and as I remembered, I had to practically ad-lib the closing of the show. But it was well worth it, and it's a scene that will remain in my mind as long as I live.
During World War II, Toscanini raised vast sums of money for our government by directing his orchestra in war bond concerts. One of the highlights of these concerts always came when the maestro led the orchestra in the stirring strains of the march, Stars and Stripes Forever.
think it's interesting and a little-known fact that at one time Toscanini had some aspirations as a composer. More about this early chapter in the life of the maestro from NBC correspondent Jack Pagan.
Recently, during an unforgettable day at the Parma Conservatory, I saw the little cell-like room where Toscanini began his cello studies. I met a grand old maestro, the director of the conservatory. Maestro Luigi Ferrari Trecatti is well known in Italy for his operatic works, mostly dedicated to children, such as Ghirlino, L'Osso Re, and Buricchio, which have been presented at La Scala and other major Italian opera houses. He is also the author of a lyrical tragedy based on Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin, which has been presented in Italy, but not yet in America. In the director's office, Maestro Trecatti brought out the scholastic file of one Arturo Toscanini. We found there an andante composed by Toscanini at the close of the scholastic year of 1874, and a symphony, his graduation composition. But we also found an unpublished romantic composition for piano and voice written earlier by Toscanini with words by the great Italian poet Stacchetti. The old maestro sat at the piano in his office and ran through Toscanini's childhood composition to give us an idea of perhaps his first masterpiece. And here it is, played and sung by the director of the Parma Conservatory, Maestro Ferrari Trecatti.
Toscanini, brano che egli ha scritto mentre era allievo di questo glorioso conservatorio. Mi si dice che questa musica fu da lui scritta in un attimo, da queste note commoventi ed espressive. Fin da allora si delineava l'artista che tutti noi oggi onoriamo. E con animo commosso e trepidante, io chiedo scusa al maestro se con l'emozione non ho potuto eseguire proprio perfettamente questa deliziosa pagina.
As he finished playing, tears were streaming down his fine old face, and he said, "At first glance, I have played a short composition written by Maestro Arturo Toscanini, a piece which he composed while he was a student of this glorious conservatory. I'm told that this music was written about in 1873 by him in just a moment of his spare time. But from these moving and expressive notes, you could see the artist being formed. And with a humble and trembling heart, I beg to excuse myself to the maestro if, moved by emotion, I could not perfectly execute this charming page of music. A message from the director of the Parma Conservatory of Music, Maestro Ferrari Trecarte."
On April 4th, 1954, an expectant and excited audience took their seats in Carnegie Hall. The orchestra was ready, and all across the country, people beside their radios were tuned in for another Toscanini broadcast concert. What they did not know was that, at 87 years of age, the maestro had decided to retire, that this would be the last time he would conduct the NBC Symphony. The closing number on that all Wagner program was the prelude from Die Meistersinger. Slowly back to his dressing room, and his head back. Neither the orchestra itself nor the cheering audience in the hall knew that this was the maestro's farewell, which was as he had wanted. He left it as he had always worked, simply and modestly. He retired to his home in Riverdale, New York, where he delighted in playing with his grandchildren and watching boxing and wrestling on television in receiving old and special friends. The first news of his death reached the world when Merrill Muller announced it over the NBC radio network at 9:50 yesterday morning. For one final word on the maestro, here is the music critic of the New York Times, Mr. Howard Taubman.
"My heart is too full for a long statement at this time. The best I can do is to read my editorial in this morning's New York Times as follows. Arturo Toscanini was like a flaming sun which shed a vivifying light on music. His death does not mean that this sun has sunk forever. It irradiates all the performances imprisoned on discs and tape, reminding us of the purity and consecration of his musical faith. The little maestro of the flaming spirit knew no compromise in his art or personal life. To each score he undertook, he brought a determination that its inner meaning must be proclaimed. He battled relentlessly with all, musicians, managers, and patrons, to give the beating heart of the music its full, rich life. Nor did he spare himself. If a piece did not go well, he could tear his clothes and rend his flesh. If it went superbly, he remarked mildly that the result was not bad, but that there must be improvements the next time. In pursuit of his musical ideals, he was a thoroughly practical musician who knew how to teach as well as to inspire his forces. His idealism reached out into every corner of life. On the overwhelming issues of the freedom and dignity of the individual, he was like a conscience. He stood up to Mussolini. He defied Hitler. He defended the right of his beloved Italy to choose a democratic form of government. He did not do these things in a search of headlines. In affairs other than his music, he hoped to avoid public attention. But the public, whether it cared for music or not, recognized a man it could respect and love. Arturo Toscanini's death marks the end of an era. It is as though something precious had gone out of our lives. There are not many men of his passionate ardor and dedication in any age. Our mourning is assuaged only by the thought that he lived a gloriously abundant life. He had done his work, and for generations we shall be the richer because he dwelt among us.
This is Ben Grauer again. All of us in the NBC family echo the statement of Brigadier General David Sarnoff, Chairman of the Board of the Radio Corporation of America, on the death of Arturo Toscanini. Said General Sarnoff, "The death of Maestro Arturo Toscanini deprives the world of its greatest interpretive musician. For 18 years, Maestro Toscanini presided over the NBC Symphony, giving to America and through shortwave and transcriptions to the rest of the world performances of the classics, both instrumental and operatic, that were unparalleled for depth, brilliance, and musical perfection. But at this sad moment, I remember the warm friend rather than the master musician. Maestro Toscanini was not only a genius in music, but a great man in life. He believed deeply in democratic ideals and devoted much of his life to the furtherance of them. My heart goes out to his devoted family and to his numberless admirers all over the world."
I've just heard a repeat broadcast of The Man Behind the Legend, a tribute to Arturo Toscanini. The narrator was Ben Grauer. This was an NBC Radio Network production.
This is the NBC Radio Network.